In these series of lectures, I'm referring to a period of time that I call the Christian Empire. Generally, that's from the conversion of Constantine in AD 312 to about the year 1500, which is right on the threshold of the Protestant Reformation. In that very long period of almost 1200 years, I divide it into roughly two periods, an earlier period from 312 to about the year 1000, and a later period from about the year 1000 to 1500. In this general period that I call the Christian Empire, the church was highly structured as an institution. In the East, it was under the Orthodox churches, and in the West, of course, it was under the Roman Catholic Church. In these centuries, the authority of the church was often expressed through the state, through the government, through the rulers. So if the church declared someone to be a heretic, it wasn't just a religious problem, it was also a crime against the state. Usually the rulers in the East and the West implemented the policy of the organized institutional church. But there has always existed communities of believers, and I would say genuine believers in Jesus Christ, that were outside the official and recognized churches. These are what one might call a believer's church or a pilgrim church. Now, there's a 1931 book by a man named E.H. Broadbent titled The Pilgrim Church. It's a wonderful resource for this subject. This is my particular copy. I purchased a few years ago, and of course, I've read through it a few times. And I appreciate his general take that the true histories of these groups have often been destroyed, and we usually only know about them from their critics. And their critics were often not fair to them. What they mostly feared, and I'm speaking of what their critics mostly feared from these groups that we could call the believers' churches or the pilgrim churches, was that they wanted to be Christians outside of the institutional church. And that alone made them enemies and often declared to be heretics. They usually referred to themselves simply as Christians or brethren, but they were often wrongly associated with heretics and usually referred to by names that they would never take unto themselves. So even in the first three centuries, there were several bodies of Christians who would protest against the growing laxity and worldliness of the church. They would protest against the departure from the teaching of scriptures that they found. And again, these are all thoughts from Broadbent's book, The Pilgrim Church. So what we want to do in this particular lecture is take a look at some of these diverse, independent movements that were outside either the Roman Catholic or the Eastern Orthodox Church. We're going to take a look at four examples, namely the Paulicans, the Bogomils, the Petrobusians, that is the movement started by Peter of Bruges, I should say, and the Albigensians, or the Albigenses. So what we want to do is just take a look at these four movements and note a few things about them and see what conclusions we can kind of draw. Now, according to the article by J. Norman, in the New International Dictionary of the Christian Church. I just wanted to show you this book. You know, in the days before Google and Wikipedia, we actually used resources like this that were just handy, quick reference works that would give us an understanding of, you know, what this group was or what this person did or what this event signified. So Norman, writing in his article on the Paulicans in the New International Dictionary of the Christian Church, said that they were an evangelical anti-heriarchical sect originating in the 7th century. I'm just caught by his immediate description. First of all, evangelical, meaning that they were committed to the gospel. Secondly, that they were anti-hierarchical. In other words, that they were against the established institutional hierarchical church of its day. And then Norman goes on to lists four, or at least four, errors of the Paulicans. And the four errors were these. First of all, that they had an adoptionist Christology. That essentially means that Jesus wasn't the Messiah, the Christ, but that he became the Messiah, the Christ. Normally, these adoptionist perspectives would say at his baptism, he was adopted as the Christ, the Messiah. Then they had a rejection of Mariology, that is the worship of Mary. There was a rejection of images and the veneration of the saints. And then fourthly, it was said that they favored Paul above other human authors of Scripture. That's why they were often called the Paulicans, because they were said to be followers of Paul more than anybody else. The story of the Paulicans runs something like this. About the year 653, a man named Constantine received a man on a journey. The traveler was an Armenian man who was captured by the Saracens and then was released, and then he was on his way back home. And as Constantine spent time with his Armenian guest, it was apparent that the Armenian visitor had something precious that he was very excited about. He had a manuscript that contained the four Gospels and the letters of Paul. He ended up leaving it with Constantine, who made these writings the focus of his constant study. So here's a Constantine, a man who had never been exposed to the written scriptures before, and now he had at least a partial New Testament in his grasp, the Gospels and the letters of the Apostle Paul. And his life was radically changed by the scriptures. He changed his name to Silvanus, because he's a man in the New Testament who was the constant companion of the Apostle Paul. He kind of networked and connected with other believers who didn't like the icon worship and the superstitious nature of some of the Eastern Church, the Orthodox Church, the Byzantine Church of that day. And because of these things, he became a target of persecution. For about 30 years, this man, Constantine, who changed his name to Silvanus, he worked in Armenia and traveled all around the region doing ministry. By the year 684, his ministry was so effective that the emperor issued a decree against these congregations of believers and against Silvanus personally. The emperor sent a special aide named Simeon to arrest Silvanus and to stop him. But when he found him, he gathered many of his followers. He gave them all rocks and commanded them to stone Silvanus to death. They all refused. And this was, of course, at the risk of their own lives. But eventually, this man, Simeon, found one man named Justus, who had been brought up by Silvanus as an adopted son. He had received much special kindness from him. This man, Justus, was willing really to betray his adopted father, Silvanus. And he did, and he executed him. Simeon was so affected by all of this, by the bravery of Silvanus and his martyrdom, by the rallying of all the community around Silvanus, except for this one man, Justus. He was so affected by this that Simeon converted and became a follower of Silvanus even after his death and his ideas. Another leader of those called the Paulicans was a man named Sergius. In Armenian, I guess you would say his name was Sarkis. He said of his ministry of 34 years, and again, he was more than 100 years after the time of Silvanus, the years 800 to 834. He said this, "I have run from east to west and from north to south, preaching the gospel of Christ until my knees were weary." He worked as a carpenter, but he traveled widely, preaching, healing divisions among Christians, and sharing God's love. This is what Broadbent writes about the conversion of this man, Sergius. He says his conversion came about through his being persuaded to read the scriptures. A believing woman asked him why he did not read the divine gospels. He explained that only priests might do this and not the lay people. She replied that God is no respecter of persons, but desires that all be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth, and that it is a trick of the priest to deprive the people of their share in the gospels. So Sergius read and believed, and he long testified most effectively for Christ. It is said that the letters that Sergius wrote were circulated widely, and they were greatly valued. And the only thing that could stop his ministry was death. He actually was cut in two with an axe by his persecutors. But he influenced many people, and he left many people who carried on his work. These men labored during a span of some 200 years, from the middle of the 7th century when Silvanus began his work to the middle of the 9th century. Again, Broadbent says that he was one of the most distinguished of a series of men whose godly character and devoted service enshrine their names in the memory of a heroic people. Now, at times, these Paulicans were persecuted mercilessly. It was claimed that between the years 842 and 867, the zeal of Theodora, that was the wife of the emperor, or you could call her the empress, the zeal of Theodora and her inquisitors had brought about the death of 100,000 persons in the Byzantine Empire. That figure of 100,000 in a span of 20 years seems remarkable, but it's noted by both Broadbent and by Norman in his article in the Dictionary of the Christian Church. As an example of their commitment, it's shown in part of the baptismal statement of the Paulicans. Sometimes in some places when the Paulicans were going to baptize somebody, this is what they would ask the candidate for baptism. Are you then able to drink the cup which I am about to drink, or to be baptized with the baptism which I am about to be baptized? They're echoing the question that Jesus asked James and John when they said that they wanted to follow him and receive special favors in his kingdom. And this was to be the answer of the baptismal candidate. I take on myself scourgings, imprisonment, tortures, reproaches, crosses, blows, tribulations, and all temptations of the world, which our Lord and intercessor of the universal and apostolic Holy Church took upon themselves and lovingly accepted them. So even do I, an unworthy servant of Jesus Christ, with great love and ready will, take upon myself all these until the hour of my death. So again, we see a very strong commitment and focus upon Jesus Christ among the followers of the Paulicans. Now, as late as even the 17th century, there were some congregations known as Paulicans in parts of Bulgaria, reaching even north of the Danube, where they were described by the Orthodox Church as being convinced heretics and as those who condemned the Orthodox Church as idolatrous. Norman says in his article, they continued to exist in scattered communities in Armenia, Asia Minor, and the Balkans, influential at least until the 12th century, even spreading to Italy and France. The Crusaders found them everywhere in Syria and Palestine. So I find the understanding of the Paulicans to be very interesting. And if I could, before we go on and discuss a second group, just to review for ourselves what were the claimed errors of the Paulicans. First of all, they had said to have an adoptionist Christology, but notice they rejected Mariology. They rejected the worship or the veneration of Mary, and they rejected the images and veneration of the saints. And it is said that they favored Paul above other human authors of Scripture. Well, I wonder about the first charge of a defective understanding of Jesus. Was that accurate? Was it an exaggeration? Because again, there's a tendency with the institutional church, especially of those ages, but the same tendency exists today in some regard. The churches of the East under the Orthodox communions, the churches of the West certainly under the Roman Catholic Church, to regard anybody as dangerous heretics who just doesn't want to fit under their fold. That they have to encompass everything that is Christian wherever they have authority or influence. So it just makes me wonder, to what effect, to what degree was the understanding or the doctrine of the Paulicans truly heretical? Maybe it was. Maybe they were so lost in their adoptionist Christology, if they had one at all. Maybe they were so lost in it that they just really could not be understood to preach a biblical Jesus. Or maybe that accusation was a gross exaggeration from their critics. Well, interesting things to think about. Let's take a look at a second group, the Bogomils, that is, those who were the friends of God. In the 9th century in Bulgaria, there arose a group often called the Bogomils. It's a Slavic name meaning the friends of God. George Giacoumakis, writing again in the New International Dictionary of the Christian Church, this is what he says about the Bogomils. He describes them as a group that arose toward the latter part of the 11th century, especially in Bulgaria, and was considered heretical by the Eastern Orthodox Church. Much of what is known about them comes from hostile writers sympathetic to the established church of the day. Their views of the sacraments were in some ways similar to several Protestant groups in later centuries. The Bogomils opposed the sacramental materialism of the church. And Giacoumakis listed some of the errors that the Bogomils were accused of. So here are the claimed errors of the Bogomils. Sometimes in the literature, I find their name written with an E in it and sometimes without, but I think it's pronounced Bogomils. Number one, it is said that they opposed the sacramental materialism of the church. Number two, they held that spiritual baptism was important, not water baptism. According to Giacoumakis, the spiritual baptism embraced by the Bogomils took place by the laying of the Gospel of John, I mean an actual book of the Gospel of John, upon the head of the subject being baptized and then chanting the Lord's Prayer, which would certainly be a strange way to baptize anybody. They were also said to have received the bread and the cup of communion spiritually, not materially or physically. And it is said of the Bogomils that they rejected almost all of the Old Testament. Now, writing about them in his book, The Pilgrim Church, Broadbent says this: out of a multitude of whose very names have been forgotten, the memory of a few has been preserved. One of them is Basil, who, through continuing to practice as a physician in order to earn his living, he set a good example of, and so as to rebuke the lazy lives of those who made religion an excuse for begging. He was, for some 40 years of his life, an unstoppable man in his preaching and teaching. It is said, again, according to Broadbent, that Basil was invited to speak to the Byzantine emperor. And when he was alone with the emperor, he spoke to him freely and very passionately about Jesus and the Christian life. But then suddenly, the emperor opened a curtain that revealed a scribe who had written down everything that Basil had said in shorthand, and they used his own words as evidence against him. They threw him into prison, where he stayed for some 8 years, refusing to deny the truths that he told the emperor. Then he was publicly burnt at the end of those 8 years at the Hippodrome in Constantinople. That event is described by Broadbent in the sources he quotes. It said that at that burning of Basil at the Hippodrome in Constantinople, that the emperor's daughter said that the events were all quite satisfactory to her, that Basil was a lanky man with a sparse beard, tall and thin, and she commented on how the fire crackled and how Basil turned his eyes from the sight of the flame and how he shook as they took him to it. In the persecutions that followed against the Bogomils, the princess, that is the daughter of the emperor, laughed at their very low origins, that they looked like peasants and commoners, and how they had the habit of bowing their heads and muttering something with their lips, no doubt praying often. One writer named Eurythmus, who died in 1118, he wrote this. He said, "They bid those who listened to their doctrines to keep the commandments of the gospel and to be meek and merciful and of brotherly love. Thus they entice men on by teaching all good things and useful doctrines, but they poison by degrees and draw to perdition." And then there's another quote by Broadbent about a man named Cosmas, who describes the Bogomils. Here we read, "Cosmas, a Bulgarian elder writing at the end of the 10th century, describes the Bogomils as worse and more horrible than demons, denies their belief in the Old Testament or the Gospels, says they pay no honor to the Mother of God nor to the cross, that they revile the ceremonies of the church and all church dignitaries. They call Orthodox priests blind Pharisees. They say that the Lord's Supper is not kept according to God's commandment and that the bread is not the body of God, but ordinary bread." Now, again, we can see how some of these accusations may be completely accurate. They did not worship Mary or venerate her, as would be common among some in the Orthodox Church of that day. They weren't into all the sometimes elaborate ceremonies of the Orthodox Church of that time. They didn't respect the leaders of the Orthodox Church. They didn't want to be under the Orthodox Church and follow their customs. So no doubt some of those were true. Again, as with the previous case of the Paulicans, you just have to wonder about the accuracy of the things that they're accused of, such as being those who reject the Old Testament and the Gospels. You have to really wonder about it. Were these just baseless accusations made by the institutional church, or were they in fact accurate? Because of persecution from the east, they also spread west into the areas of Bosnia. There's evidence that they had strength there even until the 15th century, 1463, when that area of Europe was again conquered by the Turks and the region was put under Islam. Now, a third group I want to take a look at is a man who headed this movement called Peter de Bruys and the Petrobusians. Petrobusians just simply means followers of Peter, and this would be Peter or Pierre de Bruys of France. There arose movements of genuine Christians in Europe. Sometimes they were influenced by other earlier groups, such as the Bogomils, the Friends of God from Serbia in the south. Sometimes they arose from within the Roman Catholic Church as people just got right with God, I would say. One example of this was a man named Peter from a small French village named Bruys. And this is how one dictionary begins to describe him. Again, this is Williams writing in the New International Dictionary of the Christian Church. He describes Peter de Bruys as this: "He was a heretical preacher, beginning in the insignificant French village of Bruys. He preached against the church of the day." And again, this man, for some 20 years, he was a skilled and hardworking preacher. And he bravely traveled throughout France, preaching against the superstitions of the day and for the simple truths of the Bible. Now, again, according to both Williams and Broadbent, these are some of the things that Peter de Bruys taught. First of all, that baptism should be for believers and not for infants, that there was no need for fancy and expensive churches, that the crucifix should not be venerated or worshipped, that the bread and wine of communion are not actually changed into the body and blood of Jesus, that the prayers and good works of the living cannot help the dead, and that only personal faith can bring salvation. Now again, you and I would look at that list, and for the most part, we would say, right on. But again, since he was very much against the Roman Catholic Church of his day, branded as a dangerous heretic. Now soon, a very powerful monk named Henry joined de Bruys, and Henry was a powerful and popular preacher of what they both believed. Their movement was so popular that the leading church figure in Europe at the time, Bernard of Clairvaux, was called upon to oppose Peter and Henry. Bernard found that the churches were empty and the people were totally turned off to the priest because of the influence of Peter de Bruys. So Peter was captured and burned to death at St. Giles in 1126. Henry was able to escape capture for a long time, and he continued his fearless ministry, but at last he was caught and imprisoned, and he died in imprisonment, either of natural causes, or perhaps he was executed in the year 1147. Williams also writes of Peter de Bruys that his distinctive teaching, which relates faith to salvation more clearly than almost anybody before Luther. And again, I just want you to reflect on that for a moment. That this was a man who, before the times of Martin Luther, explained salvation by faith on a personal level for the individual more clearly than just about anybody else. But again, branded as a heretic and died condemned by the Roman Catholic Church as a heretic. Let's consider one fourth movement along the way, the Albigensians, or the Albigenses, as they're sometimes called. This was a movement about the middle of the 12th century, a movement often called the Albigenses, began to appear. Among the people, they were most often called the good men. And, to quote Broadbent, there's a general testimony to the fact that their manner of life was a pattern to all, and especially that their simplicity and piety were a contrast to the self-indulgence of the clergy. Broadbent goes on to say that they're often called Albigenses. Again, that's a word I just have difficulty saying. It's a name taken from Albi, a district or a city where there were many of them. But this name was never used by them of themselves, and nor was it used of them until a later period. According to Robert Claus, again in the New International Dictionary of the Christian Church, these were the claimed errors of the Albigenses. Oh, good heavens, I have a difficulty with that name for some reason. Anyway, these were their claimed errors. Their religion was dualistic, with a God of light, who is revealed in the New Testament, and a God of darkness, revealed in the Old Testament. Secondly, they regarded life on earth as being a struggle between these two gods. They said that the good life for man was a gradual purification from the material world and its corruptions. That they condemned marriage, having children, eating food, and the use of any material thing in worship. And they refused to take oaths and believed that all human government was wicked. Finally, they did not believe in hell or in purgatory. Now, again, what do we make of these accusations? If we are to regard these accusations as being somewhat true, we would say that the Albigenses are different. They're worse than the Paulicans, worse than the Bogomils, worse than the Petrobusians, the followers of Peter de Bruys. We would say that they're more distant from orthodoxy and perhaps heretics. But then again, we are stuck with the very difficult issue. How much do we know from them when all we hear from them is from their critics and the people who condemn them as heretics? How accurate were their critics in describing what they really believed? These are things that are just very difficult to determine with any kind of confidence from history. According to Broadbent, they had intimate or close connection with the Brethren, whether they were called the Waldenses, the Poor Men of Lyon, the Bogomils, or whatever, but in the surrounding countries where churches spread among the various peoples. He says that Pope Innocent III required of the Count of Toulouse, Raymond VI, who ruled in Provence, and other rulers and prelates of the south of France, that these heretics should be banished. Raymond VI was reluctant, and eventually the Pope declared a crusade against such heretics in the region in the year 1209. This was an example, again, cited by Broadbent in some of the way that persecution came to these followers. He writes this: when the town of Béziers was summoned to surrender, the Catholic inhabitants joined with the dissenters in refusing, though warned that if the place were taken, no soul should be left alive. The town was captured, and of the tens of thousands who had taken refuge there, none were spared. At the capture of another place, La Minerve, about 140 believers were found, women in one house, men another, engaged in prayer as they awaited their doom. De Montfort had said that a great pile of wood was prepared and told them to be converted to the Roman Catholic faith or climb on that pile. They answered that they owned to papal or priestly authority nothing, and that only to Christ and his word. The fire was lighted, and the confessors, without hesitation, entered the flames. Now, again, there are heretics who sometimes die very bravely. But oftentimes, the willingness to hold on to a belief until death can be, it's not absolute by any means, but it can be an evidence to an integrity of doctrine. So I'm not here to testify on behalf of the Albigenses, but just simply to say that we should at least be careful in our assessment of them. Now, in this general period, now we're talking 13th century in Europe, Broadbent quotes the words of an inquisitor named Rienerus. He died in 1259, and he left this record regarding a group, the Waldenses. We're going to consider the Waldenses in a future lecture, but I just wanted to give at least this quote regarding them, because they're very much along the same kind of lines as the Paulicans, the Bogomils, the Petrobusians, the Albigenses, although we're recognized that perhaps the Albigenses were as serious in their error as represented. We're just a little more uncertain about that. But here is what Inquisitor Rienerus said about the Waldenses, people who were also outside the institutional church. He wrote this: concerning the sects of the ancient heretics, observe that there have been more than 70, all of which, except the sects of the Manichaeans and the Arians and the Runcarians and the Waldenses, which have infected Germany, have through the favor of God been destroyed. Among all those sects, which either still exist or which have formerly existed, there is not one more pernicious to the church than that of the Leonists. He means the Waldenses. And this is for three reasons. The first is because it has been of longer continuance. For some say that it has lasted from the time of Sylvester, other from the time of the apostles. The second reason is because it is more general, for there is scarcely any land in which this sect does not exist. Let me pause just for a moment, going on to the next slide of this statement of the Inquisitor Rienerus. He says the two reasons why the Waldenses were so dangerous was, number one, they've been around forever, maybe even back to the apostles. That should maybe give you pause. Number two is that they are everywhere. They are embraced by the popular people. And then here is the third reason is, he says, the third reason is because while other sects, through the enormity of their blasphemies against God, strike horror into the hearers, this of the Waldenses has such a great semblance, that is, an appearance of piety, inasmuch as they live justly before men and believe every point, well respecting God together, will all the articles contained in the creed. Only they blaspheme the Roman church and clergy, to which the multitude of the laity are ready enough to give credence. Look, let me just summarize Inquisitor Renius against them. About the only thing he could really say against them is that they spoke against the Roman Catholic Church. As far as we know, that was their great crime or heresy. So, we have these groups that come up throughout church history that are often and almost always condemned as being terrible heretics. But when you dig into their history, it's not so clear. Maybe they were heretics and had serious errors of theology. But certainly, in the view of the day, their greatest crime was simply not wanting to be under the umbrella of the bureaucracy and the institution of the great ruling churches of their day, whether they be the Orthodox churches of the East or the Roman Catholic Church of the West. Now, why? Why was this unity in the church so severely enforced? Well, like many things in history, the story of these ancient groups that were branded heretics, it's often complicated. Were they really heretics, or did they just reject the institutional church in either the East or the West? It's often hard to tell. Were they guilty of all that they were accused of? Were their beliefs accurately explained by their critics and their persecutors? What we do know is that they were persecuted, and often severely. Look, everybody believes that unity is good in the church. And it's good to protect the unity of the church and to promote the unity of the church. Yet in this period of the Christian Empire, the medieval church, if you want to use that phrasing, they used strong and violent measures to protect unity and to punish those they called heretics. Why? What was their justification for using violence to kill heretics to enforce unity in the church? Well, medieval Roman Catholics, and I suppose many in the Eastern Church as well, basically thought that heresy was a greater crime than violence against heresy. You see, the theological foundation for this comes from the writings of Augustine, who argued based on the parable of the banquet. You'll find that in Luke chapter 14, starting at verse 15. On the basis of the parable of the banquet, that it was permissible for the church to compel them to come, and if necessary, to compel them by violence and torture. And this became the standard justification in the medieval church. Do you compel them to come in, forcing them, so to speak, to sit at the Lord's banquet? Or do you regard the parable of the wheat and the tares that Jesus spoke of in Matthew chapter 13? You remember the parable of the wheat and the tares, where Jesus basically said, the tares or the weeds are going to grow up among the wheat. Let them grow. At the harvest, God will sort it out. But this standard justification of compel them to come in was used throughout the Middle Ages to justify the use of force in religious disputes. Now, certainly God does not want his people, and especially leaders among his people, to be entirely passive in the face of heresy and false doctrine. But these examples from the medieval church show us, at least it shows me, you can make your own opinion, that it really isn't within the place of the church to be the instruments of violence against heretics, against persecutors, nor to allow the state to do it under the guise of it's not the church, it's the state. In any regard, I think that these were dark things in the history of the church, and that it would take time until a better way was established. That's it for this particular lecture. So pleased that you could join us. Continue on with us, please, as we continue to walk through the history of Christianity. These lectures concern what we might call the first part of Christian history up to the Reformation. And this particular lecture has been on general trends and developments in the Christian Empire period from the year 312 to 1500. Thanks for joining us. Hope you can join us again for later lectures.